Hi there, my name is Oisin Lunny and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman. And in this episode, we are going to meet one of the greatest names in modern music, a super heavy creative giant whose work has moved the hearts of millions through his countless hits, epic productions, musicals, concerts and legendary scores for over 145 movies. He was named as one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine, and his work has been recognised with no less than 7 Oscar nominations and 2 wins. He joins us from beautiful Chennai in God's own country of India. Welcome to the Harman Audio Talks podcast, the Mozart of Madras, A.R. Rahman.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here, A.R. Absolute pleasure. So let's start at the beginning, if we may. Talk to us a bit about when and how did you start making music?
I started music when I was very young, and my father passed away when I was 9. And so I started as a session musician when I was 12. I was doing schooling and then going, playing programs and stuff. Then when I was 18, I got this interest to do jingles, and actually doing a lot of jingles, around 230, 300 jingles. And then I got my first break when I was 23, 24. And yeah, that movie, which the first movie, became a major hit. And even though I was not intentionally trying to do film music, because I wanted to go away from film music, because I was there in films from childhood in South Indian movies, but I think destiny has its way.
Absolutely. And I've seen that you embrace music technology very much, as well as mixing it with beautiful classical instruments. What's the role of music technology been as your career evolved through those different stages?
Well, my father had a Korg SH-700. Wow. And he was one of the first ones to get it. And he got a free ticket to Japan in 73, 74 when he went to Singapore. And so when he passed away in 76, I had, you know, the synthesizer, I had combo organs and all the stuff. So my toys were all those. And he had a rhythm box and, you know, so many stuff. So my toys were these, because it was all there, lying there after he passed away. And I could, you know, I played in television like a little boy and all the stuff. And then my curiosity was, what next? And then MIDI came in, you know, musical instrument. MIDI came in around 86, 87, and my life changed. So the dependency on, I'm composing something, I need musicians to record, changed. Oh, I can do something within my headphones,
yeah,
and listen to it. And if it's good, nobody's going to, you know, humiliate me if it's bad. So that came in. And then I started my studio in 89. 89 was, huge moment for me. Mm-hmm. When I owned my own music studio, and that actually changed everything, because the moment you are alone and you have all your gear and there's no one stopping you, it's at your house, you don't have to pay rent. And I said, this is real empowerment. Something major has happened, and that changed my life. Yeah.
Wow, fantastic. So it sounds like music technology has had a real positive transformational role throughout your entire career. That's amazing. But I read once that in this home studio, it was very empowering, but also there were issues with the power supply sometimes. So you had to, you know, you were working round the clock, doing all these jingles, doing all this work, and you had to have a kind of backup generator. But talk to us a bit about how you work today. It looks like a bit of a different setup behind you there.
Yeah, so those days, I was very slow, because I literally had to play every instrument, and I've used the strings and everything, but yeah. The post-production was mostly everything, like tuning, chopping, you know, recording, everything was me. And then my friend H3, they used to come for mixing alone. So my speed was like probably 20 times slower than other composers who had an orchestra and everything, because I wanted that way, in my own intimacy and also the privacy of having my music, so that I can construct and sculpt it the way I wanted. And of course, though, every festival would have a release, like Diwali is a big light festival in India. Yeah. And that's when, you know, my torture starts. Like, they would say, you have to deliver this, because we had to print it and it had to be sent for like 1,000 prints, and wow. And no sleep, company, no food, and you just go. Yeah. And now things have changed. Now we have, I have a school, and we have so many interns working, and so many students who become, you know, producers, and who are playing percussion, who can arrange some stuff, and who can mix in another studio. And we have so many studios now. Speed is, we have UPS, no more generators in the road, you know, loud generators, so that, yeah, so life has changed.
You know, throughout this process, have there been any particular composers that have really inspired and influenced you along the way?
I think many composers. First of all, here in South India, there was M.S. Vishwanathan and K.V. Mahadevan, and I was working with for Mr. Iliraja, who was very well-versed in orchestral music and folk music and all the stuff. And then, of course, John Williams and Morricone and Vangelis, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the first time somebody breathed, you know, soul into electronics, I felt like. And the switched on back, Wendy Carlos, you know, that Moog record in the 60s. That one record is, you know, it's a university by itself.
Yeah.
And still, I think, I don't know how she did that. So these are the composers. And then Hans Zimmer came in much later, where he was trying this hybrid kind of music. So these are the favorite. And of course, the greats, the Bach and Beethoven and Tchaikovsky and Stravinsky and Gershwin and, yeah, all these people, of course.
Fantastic. That's an education right there. What a playlist. And I will be asking you to add a track to our title playlist a bit later on. But going back to your past, now you studied Western music as a student, and listening to a track like China China Asai, there are a lot of Western and global pop influences in there as well. But the song is in the beautiful Tamil language. Talk to us a bit about bringing together global influences with that richness of the Indian heritage and culture. Is this something you've always been drawn towards?
When I used to play in the studios, like in the 80s, anything which was alien to them, a synth sound, I said, no, don't use that. Use an Indian instrument. So they were very picky and anal about it. But I think the jingles kind of changed the whole thing. The jingles, when I was working in the commercials, I met a younger crowd, was more open and more international. And I was doing some international commercials, doing some of the national ones. So that changed. And then what I figured out is, like, what would I like to listen as a young person? Why am I getting this boring stuff, you know, which is made for the movies? But I was more interested in, you know, Western rock bands and jazz and all those kind of things. And I said, this is what people would like, because I like this. And if we can give it to them in a package where we have poetry in Tamil and great melodies and great production, so that could change everything. The courage to do that came in when I was feeling like I should not copy anybody, but, you know, move away from the expected thing to an experimental stage which I would be proud of doing stuff. So I met, of course, my mentor, who gave my first opportunity, Mani Ratnam, whose movie just released, PS2, we scored for that. He was very supportive. He said, oh my God, I love what you're doing. Don't change. Don't listen to other people saying that, oh, this won't work. Whether it works or not, we'll be happy with it. If you are happy with it, people will be happy with it. So he was the one who gave me the courage to, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, that kind of encouragement and mentorship can really open up an entirely new horizon to you. That's beautiful to hear about that. And indeed, that big breakthrough arguably came with the soundtrack for Slumdog Millionaire on a global level. And your score picked up 15 awards, including 2 Grammys, a Golden Globe and a BAFTA. What was it like working on a movie of that epic scale? And what was the music production process like?
I think there's another famous quote, like, good opportunities come with dirty clothes. you never realize what comes to you. But I was able to recognize that I was getting into something very interesting. You don't even recognize that it's a good thing. And you had to find out. And I think there was this beautiful email from Danny Boyle saying, hey, AR, I've loved what I heard from, you know, people, your work, and I'd love to work with you. And wow. I was swamped with a lot of movies. I didn't have any time to do it. And then something told me, like, I should do this just for the heck of it, just to get a break from, you know, the normal stuff.
Yeah.
And I went to one of my friends, Ashutosh Kavarika, who was working on a movie with me. I said, can I leave your movie? Because I want to do work with Danny Boyle, and I don't think I'll get an opportunity like that again.
Wow.
He was, like, offended in a way. He said, no, you can't do this to me. But promise that you'll do the next movie. I said, yeah, of course I'll do the next movie. And so I took a break from him and accepted Danny Boyle's movie. And you know, rest was history. I just did around 18 cues with him. I didn't know that he would make and put those cues as an amazing exposure in one of the pivotal point of the movie. And what people experience, I never knew that they could experience that way, because usually I do like 130 cues and some of them get buried. And but Danny uses, like, you know, he uses his cues like to drive the screenplay. And then on scenes, he never uses anything. So he has this amazing vision about music. And so it all worked out in the end. And then, yeah.
Wow. Fantastic. That's amazing. That sounds like a real bit of good luck, but also maybe some guidance from your higher self or something like this. It was a real moment of divine inspiration. But I'd be interested to know, what was the single most challenging film project you've ever worked on so far? And what did you learn from it?
So far, everything's been good. Like, those who come to me know what I could do. Because, you know, when you get a movie from your agent is when things could go wrong, because there would be another expectation. But those who have come to me mostly have come for what I am. They've listened to something and so, can you do the stuff like this? Can you? And then I said, no, I don't have to do the old stuff. I'll try something new. And it's this friendship and understanding and the trust is what makes music work. Sometimes, you know, you take time to find that one theme, and sometimes I have it already. And I think mostly it's the only trouble when we have, you know, limitations is like, you don't have enough time to complete the music, but there's a release date fixed. You know, that happens a lot in India. It used to happen. Now things have changed.
Yeah.
And any festival, I told you, like the festival comes in, boom, that they'll just finish 1 month before the festival. I said, now we need the score. Now we need to release it. And now, because those days they had to put prints, now it's just a cube. It's just a hard disk. So we can upload it. So things have changed again. Some of the movies, you just uploaded we finished the score just 3 days before the release.
Wow.
So technology is actually kind of, yeah.
It's a double-edged sword there. You know, the deadline's extended closer and closer to the release date, but it sounds like you handle it all with very typical calmness. Do you have any routines for kind of maintaining that sense of calm and perspective?
Yeah, I think, you know, that I follow the Sufi path, and it's one of the ways to reach sublime, and it's about, you know, annihilating your ego. And so this kind of helps you, like all the evils of what comes with fame and money and pride and everything is destroyed even before it comes to you. At least you try to destroy it. And that helps you to see the reality. The reality is like, we're all temporary here. We're just on an excursion. And when you realize that, there's no pressure. There's no pressure. There's trust, and people trust you. You have a sincerely, there's ambition, which also causes, you know, breathlessness. Yeah. And, oh my God, I got to finish this. I need to, this sense of when people trust you, you work towards it passionately. You have, under your leadership, you know, you bring all your people up to speed. Yeah. Sometimes it gets a bit aggressive, but we all enjoy what we do. And that's the secret of the peace.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, there's, from the sound of things, there's a lot to be said for harnessing the power of passion and a shared commitment rather than stress and pressure and the things that we associate with that ego-led approach to fame and success, as you say. So that's really inspiring. That's absolutely brilliant. Thank you. And talk to us a bit about your virtual reality project. That's super interesting, called Le Musk. How did this come about? Because it feels like a real transition from your previous projects.
Yeah, I mean, after the Oscars, I was hanging out in Hollywood and meet friends who are scriptwriters and cameramen and you know, go to the technology, you know, workshops, and just sort of, because in Hollywood, you just do one score, right?
Yeah.
Not unlike in Chennai, where I do like seven things at the same time in seven different studios. There you go. And they're watching you. What are you doing? Are you doing my movie? You know, so just chilled out. Like, you know, Monday to Friday, you work, and Saturday, Sunday, you just go out for all the stuff.
Yeah.
And one casual day, I met one of my friends, Shankar, and he said, hey, did you check out this device? And he gave me a VR, you know, Samsung.
Cool.
I was not like, I'm not going to wear that thing. So I threw it off and went back to India and said, okay, he gave it. He's a good friend. He knows what he's doing. So I bought the phone put that in.
Yeah.
And then boom, something happened. I said, oh my God. For the first time, I felt like there was a paradigm shift in experiencing, you know, movies. And I was looking around on a still picture, you know, it was a CG generated space picture where things were floating. And it's just a still, 360, 3D still. And by the same time, I was, you know, speaking to my wife, who's a big fan of perfumes. And to cheer her up, I said one day, like, why don't we make a movie on perfumes, you know, based on perfumes? And she watches crime stuff. So I made up a story. We made up a story, said, oh, this is a girl and her parents get killed and she needs to get, you know, smell and get the, you know, the people, because she's not seen the faces, but she smelled them. So that was the idea. And then whole VR and this came together, and then Intel joined the gang as a supporter of the project. And we thought, we went to Rome, we cast it and we filmed it. And I thought, like, naively, oh, I can release it in 3 months. And boom, it took 6 years to finish it.
Oh.
but we premiered at Cannes Festival, and there are amazing, kind remarks on that. And then Hollywood and Canada. Now yeah. We are trying to move it to many other places. We're trying to produce a chairs, my version of chairs, our studio version of the chairs, cost effectively, so that we can, you know, go to multiple places and put that in.
Fantastic. How exciting. And very groundbreaking as well. Nobody's ever done this before. This is just wonderful. I love the fact that you put this together with your wife as well. That's a beautiful detail. But talk to us a bit about your approach to, you know, sound with movies, because your soundtracks are immersive. You know, do you think that's very important in the movie experience? What role does sound play?
The thing is, like, I'm not limited in my imagination of, I was never limited, like, oh, this is budget and they don't have money for the orchestra.
Yeah,
I always had money for orchestra, because I always kept that music is my thing. Even if they don't pay me, I'm going to pay the orchestra. I want to get what I want, because I'm doing the movie for my passion.
Yeah.
And so that was the idea. So there was no, never in my life I limited, oh, I need a choir. Oh, they don't have the budget. I said, okay, I'll give the money, get the choir. And stuff like that. So my mind was like, if it's a small movie and if it needs a big sound, we'll go for it. It's a big movie. If it needs something smaller, yeah, we'll go for it. And so the limitations of the studio or production was never there. So my mind was like, how can I create something which is expansive and will make the people experience things in a different way rather than the tried and tested older ways?
Mm. You're kind of engineering transformational experiences, you know, journeys that people go on. Do you see a role for more technology as you're moving forward in terms of the experiences you create in the cinema and, you know, for multimedia?
Absolutely. I think now with Atmos, and, you know, I'm sitting in this whole JBL design studio, you know, M2s and all these speakers out there. And we listen to some of the Atmos audio without visual. For the first time, you don't miss a visual. Because the audio itself is so satisfying that people... Yesterday, I was recording with, a couple of days back, I was recording with Shreya Ghoshal, one of the leading singers of India. Mm. And I said, I want you to listen to one of the songs. So I played one of the songs. And she just listened to 8 bars and closed her eyes, and she listened. I was like, I didn't need any visual. For the first time, you know, wow. Audio itself is so fulfilling. And I think that's one of the breakthroughs in... audio, definitely. And audio mixes. Now, everybody's supporting Atmos mixes.
Yes.
And these speakers and this whole technology leading up to the ease of how we can do these mixes faster is also fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Wow. And do you think, you know, in this modern age, you know, you spoke about the VR headset and all this kind of stuff, you know, people have phones, they have tiny screens, little speakers, etc. Do you think great sound is still important?
Absolutely. I think the more finer we go, the more better the mixes are, the more, ambient and we can, there's so many different styles, because I think they're going to experience, the engagement of the listener is going to be more.
Yeah.
The moment it's mixed beautifully, it's not just that, because, you know, people are not paying for music anymore. It's streaming. Unlike, you know, we used to go buy a CD or a LP or, not anymore. And so for them to really, you know, catch their attention and intrigue them, I think all these things are very, very important. And it's reached the, like through the iPods or whatever, you know, those headphones, you get the experience of theater now, right? With all the new techniques, and it's more work for us, but also more jobs, which is great. It's creating more jobs in the music industry, which is great.
Definitely. So the industry is kind of rising with that entire tide of new technology, and it's kind of inspiring, and there's more opportunities for people to have these immersive experiences. And one of the things I feel about your work when I listen to it is that, you know, you take people away to a different place and time, you create empathy and a deep global sense of human connection. And you mentioned your Sufi practice earlier. Is there an element of a kind of spiritual transformation about the work that you present to the world?
Very true. Like, I think if you take an instrument player, like if you take the sarangi or the sarod or the shehnai, what they're playing is actually what they're singing. And if you ask them to sing, they're almost singing like what they're playing. So that's what reflects on the hand. Very true to a composer too. What I'm inside is going to reflect my outside, or my body is a medium, my mind is a medium to collect something beautiful and bring it to people. And if my vessel is dirty, the music is going to be dirty. The music is going to reflect what I'm inside. So it forces you to be puritanical in a way, you know, and most of the stuff like that kind of stuff, not the horror stuff, the songs and the progression. And the only way you can judge is be transparent, as like be an empty slate. To receive the blessing and whatever you believe in, you know, you might just believe in humanity, you believe in good thoughts, in the joy of giving, the joy of giving love. And each one of us have a trick to, you know, transcend to that realm. And that's what I think fuels our creativity. That's what makes us what we are. And so I respect each one's the way they're doing it, but they're using that as a resource to manifest beauty outside, whether they're artists or, you know, anybody. So,
Yeah, well said. Well said. That's beautiful. That's words to live by. And, you know, this is very much coming into your practice as somebody who inspires the world. You know, I've been so impressed with what you're doing, your focus on nurturing future generations of creatives and musicians. Tell us a bit about the KM Music Conservatory that you have down there in beautiful Chennai in India.
The KM actually came in when I used to buy, I mean, of course, you know, the big consoles, £500,000. And I used to think, like, I buy this and in 2 years I have to sell it for like 1/8. And where do we get that? What if we invest in people? What if we invest in nurturing this below poverty line? You know, that's the wealth of India. Everything is a blessing and a curse. If you want it as a blessing, it is a blessing. And I felt like it is a blessing. Having people, having souls, you know, move around earth is a blessing. And how do we nurture them to be committed to music, which is going to be beautiful later? So I think one on 2008, I told one of my colleagues that I want to start a music school and it should be free. And he said, no, don't be dumb. Free would never sell. They won't take it seriously. And he was right. So I said, okay, let's get from people, students who pay, and we'll facilitate great teachers and make this amazing. And we'll give it to the people who need it. So, so this happened. And in 3 years we had this orchestra and we have amazing students who are singing opera music and, you know, compositional stuff. And then this whole orchestra called the Sunshine Orchestra we formed, you know, taking underprivileged kids. And now they are like the shining stars, the flag bearers of our conservatory. They're playing all over the place. They can play Indian classical to folk to jazz to classical at a snap of a, you know, just see and read. And which is fantastic. And they can do the portamentos of Indian classical music to the vibrato of and rubato of Western classical. And so, so this happened because I felt like my generation of musicians were getting old and we are actually harvesting what my older generation planted and we have not planted anything. So this is the tree I planted, and with my colleagues and with all the people involved who've been kind enough to give the time. And there's some of them are even from abroad. They've come in and taken Tamil Nadu as the state and living here.
Wonderful, wonderful. And you have reached the top of the music industry in many respects, but it feels like it's very much about what you can give back. You spoke there about growing the tree, the future generations of musicians, but you also set up a foundation, the A.R. Rahman Foundation. How has this approach to sharing your success with that kind of generous heart, how does it change the way that you feel about the world?
I think there's a famous quote, "What you have is not yours, what you give is yours." And I truly believe that. And even to my kids, I said, what you have is not yours. What you give, your love, what you give, the charity you give, the nurturing you give, the smiles you give is yours. What you take is not yours. It's finite, but what you give is infinite. And why I'm saying that is that's how we are tuned. Human beings are tuned. By giving, we're receiving. And by giving, you never, you know, exhaust your wealth or your spirituality or anything. It just gets more. It's like you're cleaning the old stuff and new good things are going to come to you. And so I kind of feel odd when people want to have everything on their own. They're selfish. They don't want to give. Even praises, even you know, appreciation. I think you should be generous. You should be generous. And that goes a long way. Of course, we all learn the hard way. And we realize life teaches you what's right, what's wrong over the course of like 40 years.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you know, I think there might be in the world many people who achieve success, but they haven't been on quite the same journey spiritually as you have. And they don't really have that generous viewpoint. And it is very much about hoarding as much as possible. Do you think the world would be a better place if people with success had your approach and adopted that spirit of generosity? What do you think that could mean for the world?
I think, you know what, like my mom is an inspiration. Because she embraced that kind of idea of giving. And whether it's food or help or anything, my father was like that when he was alive. A lot of people, a lot of great musicians keep saying that your father helped me when I couldn't, you know, support my family. He said, come and sit in the last row of the violin. Whether you play or not, we'll give the money to you. So these things were very inspiring when I was growing up. I said, to have a father like that who passed away, I should be at least like 1/100th of what he is. And so he was an inspiration, definitely. Even though he died in a very, that's the dark period of my life, watching him die, all stuff. So I wouldn't say that I'm perfect and I'm like the idealistic person to follow. Everybody follows their own thing and they achieve. But the joy of giving is definitely, I'm proud of that about my family. Not being judgy about everything. I feel like everybody's equal. And our deeds and our, what we're doing is actually, you know, distinguishes from other people. And the more we do, the better. And the joy of giving, whether it's music or whether it's knowledge or facilitating things or connecting this whole divided world is the biggest achievement, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned that the work that your father was doing, kind of looking after musicians and building that sense of community, that's a very generous thing to do. But, you know, we live in an age where music technology is moving so fast. We have AI now and AI can do what many musicians can do. I mean, what do you think might happen to the master musicians in this era of AI?
Like I read something, you have to treat AI like our children. You teach what you want them to do. Right? It doesn't have a mind of its own. And we have to shape that. If we make, we can make them a monster or we can make them a good student. If you make them a monster, we are all in, you know, and leaders have to be very responsible. They have to think that human beings have families. They are the magic. They are the miracle of this world and nothing should replace them. And that responsible leaders can't just try shortcuts and try cheap things when they get money and fire people out. They need to understand there is a curse. There's a human spiritual power which will destroy them if they do anything to them, right? So we need to be responsible. Like leaders, like big corporates can't replace people. Humans are irreplaceable because if the moment when I bought the computer in 86, composers said, oh, that's it. Musicians have done. They're going to go. You know, these things are going to come and replace, but they couldn't be replaced because there's still things which musicians do and what happens with their instruments and the soul is much more faster than programming a computer to make it sound human. So what is the point of making computer monks human? Then get a. So I think that even the instrument players are much better now. They have much more. They're faster.
Yeah.
The younger generation is doing some stuff which even the older generation couldn't. They're playing better. They're singing better. Because they have knowledge from the internet, which is great.
Amazing. So the future is bright for that real human talent, but you know, we do have to look out for it in this technological age. Those are great words of advice there. And my final question for you now, AR, is when you accepted, I think it was your first Oscar, you said, "All my life, I had a choice between hate and love. I chose love and I'm here." Is there one piece of advice which has been consistently valuable throughout your entire life?
That's it. Choose love. Why? It's so generic, but you understand the layers of what it is.
Yeah.
If somebody offends you on the internet, choose love. Because that hate is going to actually not good for you. Hate is like a poison in your heart. And that comes into your heart or your brain, it's going to damage you and the other person. So better throw it out, flush it out, and keep love. And the whole world is beautiful when you look through the glasses of love.
Well said. Well said. Absolutely beautiful. And finally, could I please invite you to contribute a track for our VIP Tidal playlist?
Okay, I've done a musical called Why. I think there's a song called Beyond. It's called Beyond Time. Beyond. Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay. That's okay. And what's the reason you chose that one? Is that just close to your heart?
Yeah, I think it's listen to it, you'll understand.
Okay. Oh, beautiful. Okay, I can't wait. That's brilliant. Well, thank you so much. And I am actually going to add a track myself to our Tidal playlist, which is, of course, one of yours. It is the exquisite Mumbai theme tune. And I believe this is an adaptation of a track that was on the film Bombay, and it was featured on one of the wonderful Café Del Mar compilations many moons ago, which were my personal gateway to the incredible world of AR's music. A long time ago. So thank you so much for your wonderful music, your inspiring words, your beautiful heart, and thank you for joining us on the Harman Audio Talks podcast, AR Rahman.
Thank you so much, Harman. Thank you.
And I would also like to say a big shout to Yogesh from Harman India for organizing this. This is a real pleasure. So listeners, don't forget to subscribe, comment and share Audio Talks with your friends and family. If you're enjoying the Audio Talks series of podcasts, why not pop over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your favorite podcasts and leave a nice review. It really does mean a lot and it helps new listeners get to know about the legendary guests we talk to in every episode, like AR Rahman. In the meantime, for more exclusive content, some behind the scenes goodies and maybe even some competitions, connect with us over on Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. We'll be back soon for some more epic audio talks. See you next time.